This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
This is In Conversation. I'm Robin Williams. And if you've been listening to Movie Time just now and the doings of Mr. Borat, you might like to ask yourself, what is the Borat of biology? Well, a reverse Borat, if you like, a hoax that isn't a hoax. My choice is the platypus. They thought it can't be true, but it is. And now the platypus is to become the star once more of not only an exhibition, but a novel. The perpetrator on both counts is writer and zoologist Nick Drayson. Nick, what's up?
Well, the National Museum, as you and some of your listeners may know, Robin, inherited a large collection of biological specimens from the old Institute of Anatomy in Canberra. And amongst them, they have a fine set of pickled platypuses, a few platypus nests, a few stuffed platypuses. And they do have a wonderful platypus skin rug that was donated a few years ago. And this could be the start of something big for the museum. And they're looking to expand their collection of platypus-related objects.
I must say, before you go on, that the concept of a platypus rug is somewhat cringeworthy.
It is. I remember at the time the owner of this rug had inherited it through the family. It dates back to the 19th century. It comes from Tasmania. And it was so cringeworthy that she felt she didn't want to own it anymore. What can I do with it? And by very circuitous routes, it was given to the National Museum. So, yes, the museum is now on the lookout for other objects to expand and increase its collection. As I say, we've got enough stuffed platypuses and enough pickled platypuses. What we want now is scientific equipment that's been used to study platypuses, and I'm in contact with quite a few present-day researchers and trying to expand our collection of that kind of material. But there's also somewhere out there, Robin, I know that there's a platypus tea towel or perhaps a pair of platypus slippers or something.
You're after all of that to be sent in.
All of that. Anything with the faintest sniff of a platypus about it. In fact, I had a phone call the other day from a chap down on the south coast of New South Wales, and he was out fishing one day, and he heard a rustling in the grass, and up popped a platypus. This was in broad daylight, most unusual, because as I'm sure you know, platypuses mostly come out at night. And this platypus ran over his boots, turned around, looked up at him, and ran back over his boots and plopped back into the river. And I thought to myself, yes, those boots, that's what we need. You know, the story plus the boots would make a wonderful exhibit.
Yes.
So, yes, anything along those lines.
Now, what about various scientific firsts, such as the filming, I think this happened through Nature of Australia, of the first carnal congress that was actually witnessed between platypuses? And I really do believe that one of the people filming them happened across it.
That's long been a mystery, yes. How do platypuses do it? The anatomists have known for a long time that, of course, platypuses, being monotremes, have one hole. That's what it means, monotreme.
The cloaca.
The cloaca. That's the opening to the female's vagina, and also where the male has his penis, which is a most interesting structure, a double-branched penis.
Just like the lizards.
Indeed. It does, whether it's related or not, but it is not dissimilar to a lizard's penis. But how they actually get together has long been a mystery. But now it has been filmed. When I say filmed, of course, it's immensely difficult to film platypuses because they come out at night, because they spend most of their time either in their burrow or in the water. But yes, they've been observed twisting tails together. And
what about some of the historical stuff, such as Richard Owen, the famous head of the museum in London, the Natural History Museum, who was, okay, an opponent of Charles Darwin, but nonetheless someone who dissected the platypus and showed that it wasn't a hoax, that it was in fact a kosher mammal.
Yes, the whole story of the discovery by European science of the platypus is a fascinating one. As you say, originally it was thought by many to be a hoax, but when people realised it wasn't, well, what was it? Was it a mammal? was it something completely different? Of course, it all depends how you define mammal. And in those days, in the early 19th century, the concept was somewhat fluid. Well, are you a mammal if you have fur? Are you a mammal if you give birth to live eggs? Exactly what is the definition? And there was a lot of controversy. It's tended to line up along nationalistic lines. So the French thought one thing, and the British, your friend Owen in particular, thought another. And it wasn't until 1883 that the final proof arrived. A young Scottish biologist, William Caldwell, camped beside the Burnett River up in southern Queensland for a few months, got the local Aboriginal people to slaughter as many monotremes as they could find, hundreds of platypuses, over 1,000 echidnas, so that he could slice them up and find the sequence of the embryo that he was looking for. And he found the egg, sent off his telegram to Professor Liversidge in Sydney, and he rested his case.
Isn't it interesting? Because I would have thought that if you're looking at mammals, then mammary gland would be the defining thing. And I think Richard Owen tended in that regard because he actually showed that there was a secretion which obviously was feeding the youngsters.
Yes, yes. That was a longish story, but yes, platypuses were shown to have mammary glands. But then the question became, but we've heard that they lay eggs, or so the colonials tell us. Of course, it's absolute nonsense. What would they know? They only live there.
And Moyle's wonderful book, Platypus, tells this story, doesn't it, another person?
And Moyle has written the wonderful book, yes, on the history of platypus research. And apparently a modern researcher, Tom Grant, who's here in Sydney and has been working on platypuses for many years, is just about to publish his latest work on the biology of the platypus. I'm greatly looking forward to that.
Excellent. And what about your own novel forthcoming next year, which is based on the creature?
Ah, well, yes.
You can't give too much away, of course. But
I can't give too much away.
Rough outline.
But the name I dropped earlier, William Caldwell, this young Scottish biologist who came to Australia in the 1880s, after he'd made his discovery that, yes, platypuses do lay eggs, and he'd done some work on the embryology of the platypus, he more or less disappears from the historical record, which is a wonderful thing for a novelist. Because I've been able to take the story and add some romance and add a bushranger and add all sorts of dastardly deeds going on in the Queensland bush. And so that'll be coming out next year, Love and the Platypus.
Love and the Platypus, how wonderful. Now, you said a date before, 1883. Going back to your previous novel, that is a resonant number, isn't it?
It is, indeed. I don't know why the two novels happened to be set around about the same time. And this was, of course, the very year that Darwin died. And the theme of natural selection, I have to say, is fairly strong in both novels.
Well, let's just set the scene for Confessions to a Murder, which is a wonderful novel. In fact, I must confess, I gave it to Oliver Sacks, who fell in love with it, bought about 20 for his friends and spread them around New York. Now, here you're describing an island where it's a kind of topsy-turvy world, as they once described Australia, which is presumably no coincidence, where the creatures do... Well, you explain. What's it like on this island?
This island, which unfortunately no longer exists, it used to be in the Java Sea, and it was the home to the wonderful golden scarab beetle. And the story involves, in one way, a search for the golden scarab, and in another way, an explanation of why was it that Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace came up with this wonderful idea of natural selection. There it is.
Exactly
the same time. And perhaps you'll have to read the novel to find out. But the island itself, because it no longer exists, I was able to inhabit it with creatures of the imagination. However, being a zoologist by training, I needed to make them at least nod towards credibility.
Give us a few examples of, apart from the scarab beetle, the rather paradoxical behaviour and shape.
Yes, well, the first creature that the sailors see as they're sailing towards the island on the beach are these small, shaggy creatures, which later took the name of gadzooks. They have an interesting social system in that the female courts many males, but out of the breeding season, the males engage in homosexual sex. And I thought, well,
shouting gadzooks at each other. Go on.
little friendly grunts, I think. The female chooses the male that she wishes to mate with by the amount of salt secreted on his tail. They eat seaweed, so they have to get rid of the salt somewhere, and it tends to accumulate on their tails. And obviously the chap with the most salt on his tail must be the good fatherhood material, must know how to eat his seaweed.
And he's persuaded off homosexuality?
Briefly, yes.
I see.
Then there's, of course, the wonderful terrestrial sea cucumbers, which breed by being excreted as small sea cucumbers at the top of the mountain by storks, eventually make their way down via a circuitous route back to the sea to breed, and then the cycle starts again.
Of course, it's tremendously lucky that Charles Darwin didn't go to that island, otherwise he might have been slightly misled by what he saw.
Well, yes and no, Robin, because in some ways the island and its creatures were inspired by the Galapagos, because when Darwin went to the Galapagos, everything was new. And this island was another one where everything would have been new to him.
Yes, but there's a wonderful intrigue, the murder story itself, which I cannot divulge. And the confession of a murder is a wonderful way of tying up, as you say, the two great minds who brought us this idea of natural selection and published in 1859. And Charles Darwin was really moved along to do this because of the contact. But then in 1883, the island disappears in an explosion.
Yes, triggered actually by another explosion nearby that many people will have heard about, Krakatoa, or Krakatoa as it's known in English, which was a big one, sent shockwaves throughout the region. It was heard in Alice Springs, you may have read about that. But this triggered the collapse of my island and the demise of all the gadzooks and everything else.
Did anyone take your zoology seriously, of your readers?
Well, I got a very cross reaction from one friend because I dared put in a spoof reference, and he'd gone to the journal and looked it up, and it wasn't there, and he was a bit annoyed.
Now, you're about to set off, are you not, to Antarctica for some reason?
I am not. Bernadette is.
Oh, your partner, yes.
Yes.
She regularly goes there to collect language.
Bernadette Hintz, author of The Antarctic Dictionary, is off down south again this summer, making two trips, one to the New Zealand sub-Antarctic islands and then down to the continent itself, and one to Macquarie Island and the continent, gathering words to expand her dictionary of Antarctic English. And then straight away she'll be off to the north so that she can make it into a bipolar dictionary.
Bipolar, really? Just remind us, what sort of words are there in either pole which are unusually examples of what are part of normal discourse?
The language of Antarctica is slightly different, I suppose, from the language of the North Pole or North Polar regions, because nobody lives there, or nobody lives there permanently. So all the language is imported, much of it from the north. I think a lot of the equipment would have had its origins in the north, Nansen sledges and various kinds of mucklucks that you might wear on your feet. A lot of the special use of words in both places would describe the wildlife, obviously, the penguins in the south and the polar bears in the north. But then there are words that just have developed there spontaneously. One of my favourite is snotsicle. And I'm sure we can all imagine exactly what a snotsicle is.
And how quickly it's formed if you go out.
How quickly it's formed, indeed.
The reason I ask you about Antarctica is that I wanted to make sure that you were going to be there when all the material from the platypus public is sent in. And when you've got it organised, when do you think the platypus exhibition will be there for us all to look at?
I think the museum is thinking in terms of next year or the year after. These things take a long time to develop and get up and going. But, of course, it absolutely depends on what material comes in. As I say, we've got our pickle platypuses, but what else will be out there?
And what association has it got with stand-up comics?
That's another wonderful story, Robin. The platypus material at the National Museum of Australia was collected in the 1920s by Harry Burrell, who wrote a wonderful book about the platypus called The Platypus, which was for many years the last word on platypus biology. He was an amateur zoologist. Before he became a zoologist, he was a vaudeville comedian. How he went from one to the other, I don't know. I think it must have been the love of a good woman made him settle down.
Do you know whether he was a good comedian?
No, I'd love to find out more
about him. No recordings, I suppose.
No recordings. I've not seen any material. But I will be going later this month to Manila in New South Wales, which is where he lived with his wife and where he did most of his work around the Namoi River up in mid-New South Wales. So I'm sure I'll find out more about him.
In terms of music, you don't play music or sing yourself, do you, perhaps?
I like singing, Robin, yes.
What do you sing?
I think you could say that though I was brought up a Protestant, I have Catholic tastes.
I see. You couldn't break into anything right now, could you?
Well, I could give you the first verse, perhaps, of an entomological song.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
That I believe was made famous in the 1930s. And it goes something like this. Bzzz, bzzz. Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up busy, busy bee, whiling away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying all around the wild hedgerows, stinging all the cows upon the parson's nose. Bzzz, honey bee, bzzz if you like, but don't sting me. Bzzz, honey bee, bzzz if you like, but don't sting me.
Thank you, Nick Grayson.
Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up busy, busy bee, whiling away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying round the garden, the sweetest ever seen, taking back the honey to the dear old queen. Bzz, 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 honey bee, bzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Bzz, 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 honey bee, bzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up busy, busy bee, making hay while time is ripe, filling up the honeycomb just like tripe. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying all around the wild hedgerows, stinging all the cows upon the parson's nose. Bzz, 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 honey bee, bzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Bzz, 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 honey bee, bzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Same bee. Bzz. Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up busy, busy.
Well, my guest was Nick Grayson from the National Museum in Canberra, a very talented man. His novel was called Confessing a Murder, and Oliver Sacks thought it utterly brilliant. Coming up on Catalyst on ABC Television at 8, you can see Marika Steffen's last appearance, investigating the Bogle Chandler mystery. Was it really gas? I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.